Hey, hey! Welcome to the Bitcoin Matrix. I'm your host, Cedric Youngelman. In this episode of the Bitcoin Matrix podcast, I chat with Richard Byworth, a seasoned investment banker turned Bitcoin maximalist and digital asset strategist, live from the Bitcoin conference in Las Vegas. We dive into Richard's remarkable journey from trading convertible bonds in Tokyo to pioneering Bitcoin financial infrastructure. We explore the mechanics and evolution of convertible bonds, Bitcoin treasury strategies, and why institutional players are waking up to Bitcoin's potential. From Metaplanet and MicroStrategy to nation-state adoption and volatility arbitrage, this conversation is packed with deep insights. If you want to get in touch with me, it's Cedric at thebitcoinmatrix.com. And now, let's enter the Bitcoin Matrix with Richard Byworth.
What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
Host the Size of the Future podcast and leads the development and growth of the $250 million digital asset strategy. Richard is a board member at Swiss Bitcoin-only broker Relay and is an advisor for Jan3, the Bitcoin advisory firm to nation states. Prior to Size Capital, Richard was CEO and executive director of digital asset firm Econex, growing the firm from 5 to 250 people and listing the company on NASDAQ via SPAC. As responsible officer for the firm, Richard also oversaw the build and distribution of the fund of crypto hedge funds, Letchley Park. Prior to Econex, Richard had an 18-year career in investment banking, and most recently as managing director for Nomura Hong Kong, where he ran the global distribution for Asia-Pacific equity-linked products, including derivatives, convertible bonds, Delta One futures, and options. Richard helped build the firm's number one convertible bond franchise from 2002 and led the syndication and distribution of some of Asia's largest convertible bond deals from 2004 to 2017, including China, Unicom, and SoftBank. Richard Byworth, welcome to the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. How are you?
Cedric, I'm great. Here at the Bitcoin conference is absolutely insane.
It is insane here. Yeah.
The energy is awesome. It's quite draining as well. But yeah, I really enjoy it.
Yeah, I'm enjoying it as well. I'm really glad that we got to connect both before this and now.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'd like to hear about your background in TradeFi. Sure. And maybe like what that story was like going from, I guess, the UK to Tokyo and building a business and, yeah, and what that experience was like for you.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's it was a fun story. And yeah, I mean, I started my career in London. I was a trader. I traded convertible bonds predominantly. And then an opportunity came for me to move to Tokyo and build the business there. So I ended up managing the build of the convertible bond franchise in Tokyo for Nomura, which is like the number one broker in Japan. So, you know, you have that amazing brand to walk into. So play your cards right, you can just own the market pretty quickly. And that's exactly what we did. We went in there so I landed there. I got regulated within 2-3 months. And then 4 months later, we kicked Goldman off the number one spot for Japanese convertible bonds with international clients. And that just grew exponentially. You know, there was a point in 2008 when we had other investment banks just give up. They just, Citibank and Merrill closed their convertible bond desk. And that's the power of the Nomura brand in Japan. Like, you just really can't compete with Nomura. It's like Goldman Sachs in Japan. And so that was great. And then Nomura actually ended up acquiring Lehman Brothers, Asia and European operations. So I ended up inheriting, like, I was running a team of like 5 people, inherited a team of like another 25 people. And, you know, they were all to do derivatives and futures and options and all this stuff that we didn't even do at Nomura. So it was really interesting to do sort of that integration of a full-blown cowboy-ish investment bank from the US to the most aggressive investment bank in Japan, integrating the two cultures. It was pretty amazing, actually. I should write a book about it someday, I think. And then I decided to move to Hong Kong because the majority of my team sat in Hong Kong. The majority of clients sat in Hong Kong. So just interacting with these hedge funds day to day, it's always better to be in person. So a lot of the Asian offices were started in Hong Kong. Tokyo is very difficult. It still is today. It's to set up a financial, you know, organization like a hedge fund. And so, yeah, I sat in Hong Kong from 2009 to 2021. And in 2017, I left investment banking and I just started to learn about crypto. I didn't really understand Bitcoin. And so I moved into this company. I ended up becoming the CEO. And after about 8 months in the company, I became a Bitcoin maxi and I was running this crypto company. So it was a bit of a weird, I said to someone earlier today, you know, it's like, it's not very good for your soul to do something you're not entirely aligned with. So I was running this crypto company. I was a Bitcoin maxi. So it was quite difficult on a personal level. I really struggled with it. You know, it nearly killed me. I was very stressed all the time and, you know, trying to build this business. So 2021, my chairman and board wanted to sell the company to Binance. And I was like, okay, I don't want to be anything to do with Binance. So I'm stepping down. And I was sitting on a beach in March of 2022. And my now partner, Mark Sees, called me. We were friends from Hong Kong. And he was like, Rich, what do you think about coming around the hedge fund business and Sees Capital? I was like, yes, but we need to do something related to Bitcoin. And so he was fully for it. He's a Bitcoiner himself. And so slowly we've been orange pilling the company, the board, the banking group that's associated with Sees Capital. So yeah, it's been a lot of fun and that's what I'm doing today. And I run the podcast, Sees the Future, as well as you mentioned.
Yeah. I mean, this is really exciting. What really I'm interested here in to start, there's a lot to unpack there, is convertible bonds. I think a lot of Bitcoiners are hearing about convertible bonds a lot in the TradFi world for the first time, really, probably. And just thinking about it, and maybe in the sense of like how do maybe these entities get exposure to something they don't have exposure to. So what is the convertible bond market like? What did you see maybe 20 years ago? Has it changed? Is it different in Asia?
Yeah, I mean, look, the primary market is the US, right? So that's where the liquidity is. Like when I was trading it, you used to have Asian-centric funds focused on convertible bonds. But the market really got quite drained for liquidity in those zero interest rate environment, right? So most companies could finance their balance sheet without having to give up the upside that you do with a convertible bond. So that changed things quite a lot. And it was one of the reasons that I left traditional finance as well. But yeah, I would say that zero interest rate environment did change the convertible bond market. It really reduced issuance. So you saw the closure of a lot of Asian-focused funds or Japanese-even-focused funds. Japan's a very big market. And so, you know, what happened is everybody either closed or moved to a more global approach with convertible bonds. I think convertible bond is something that sort of eludes a lot of the people that are investing in these Bitcoin treasury products because it's not a retail product. Like, it's very hard to just go out and buy a convertible bond. The minimum increment is normally $100,000 or $1 million, right? So it's really very much an institutional investor product. So you might see it in the back end of maybe your Schroeder fund that can trade converts or something like that. But generally, it's the purview of these institutional investors like hedge funds and the like. So yeah, that's the sort of broad overview. Sure.
So the issuers of the convertible bonds are trying to raise money and the buyers are probably looking for yield, right? And yield that's better maybe in sort of the other aspects of the bond market, maybe like municipals or something. They're just looking for more yield. So right now, though, do you think the people who are buying convertible bonds from maybe Bitcoin treasury companies, are they looking for a spot exposure to Bitcoin or really for yield? Or maybe they're covering their short positions as market makers. I'm trying to figure that out.
Yeah, look, just to be clear, you don't buy a convertible bond for yield, because actually your yield will always be naturally lower in a convertible bond, because you've got that free option. You're paying for the option. So that's why Saylor can issue zero coupon convertible bonds. That's not a very interesting yield for a yield investor, right? But the reason he can do that is because the value of his option with the volatility of his stock is so high. And that's what a lot of people don't understand. I mean, how is he issuing zero coupon debt? Well, he's not. He's issuing a convertible bond. That embedded option has a lot of value.
And who values that option right now? And maybe who might come to value that option in, 18 to 24 months as the market evolves with Bitcoin treasury companies?
So there's two key investors in the convertible bond market, right? There's what we call outright investors who might want exposure to MicroStrategy stock and they can't get it because they're a convert fund, so they can't buy the equity. All right, we saw it with Allianz Insurance. They recently bought, I think, 25% of the issue of one of Saylor's convertible bonds. And, they're there for the upside in MicroStrategy and therefore the exposure to Bitcoin and the yield that he's generating. The core investor, the investor that really dominates the convertible bond market, is the hedge fund. And that's the investor that is arbitraging the volatility. So a lot of people get stuck on this, like, how do you trade volatility as a product? Well, I'm not going to go into it now, but like essentially you have, as the price of the underlying stock increases, the delta, so the equity exposure of your option goes up. As it decreases, the delta goes down. So if you think about it, if you're hedged versus equity and your delta goes down, you need to remove that hedge to some degree to balance your position. So you buy back the stock when it's low, you sell it when it's high. Buy low, sell high. It essentially gives you a position to be running that strategy without too much risk exposure. And that's where the volatility comes. You imagine a stock that goes up 8%, down 8%, up 8%, down 8%. You're making a killing, right? So this is what the volatility arbitrage guys want. And so that's what convertible bond arbitrage is, essentially.
Okay. And do you think volatility on Bitcoin, the underlying asset, will go up in the future, maybe over the next like 5 to 10 years? Or do you think it's going to kind of decrease? I think there's a lot of different sort of camps in that.
Yeah, look, it's a very good question. And actually, Bitcoin's quite unique in terms of the fact that the way the volatility prices is quite unique. So actually, you have upside skew in Bitcoin. So that means normally volatility increases when there's a crisis event, right? Everybody's panicking. They want downside protection. But with Bitcoin, because it can also go very rampant to the upside, you see the skew curve of upside volatility being priced quite high. And I think that is a sensible way of pricing Bitcoin, because when Bitcoin's doing nothing, volatility should drop. Like we're sitting around here, 107, 108. That's normal that volatility should just be declining. Or if we have a steady incline upwards, as we've had from 75K through to 110K, that's when you see volatility dropping. What's going to happen next, in my view, is you're going to have a complete lack of supply being met with a huge onslaught of demand from these corporate treasuries. I mean, we're just seeing it every day. Like Saylor's buying 2 times the Bitcoin supply. Metaplanet's buying maybe a fifth of the Bitcoin supply. You've got many, many more of these companies coming through. And so what it's doing is it's creating that, from that liquid supply, a very inelastic response, essentially. And that, when we kick, will hit upside volatility very hard. So I don't think that we're seeing a decline in volatility anytime soon. What we're going to see in the second half, as Bitcoin starts to rip because there's no sellers or very limited sellers, you'll see that volatility pick up again. You'll see MNAV pick up in these treasury companies. And so it'll be a very interesting second half, my view. not financial advice.
Yeah. And now, speaking of Bitcoin treasury companies, like, how would you describe the playbook here?
Look, the playbook is very simple. You know, you want to go out there and start raising capital through equity issuance and demonstrate to the market that you're going to be aggressive. Why has GameStop made a mess of their Bitcoin treasury strategy? Well, they raised $1.5 billion. They're sitting in $4 billion of cash, and they bought how much?
$500 million.
Exactly. So I'm not going to buy that company. That's not interesting. It's a Bitcoin treasury play. They don't understand how aggressive you need to be. MicroStrategy gets it. Metaplanet gets it. Right? These are companies that are going aggressive accretion and yield of Bitcoin. And that's the key. Like, that's why I often say to people, people ask me, you know, why don't you invest in these up and coming, like the smarter web company out of the UK? And I'm like, sure, that's fine. They need to show me how aggressive they're going to be.
Right.
Like, I can see track record with MicroStrategy. I can see track record with Metaplanet. And on top of that, for both those companies, you're seeing a lot of innovation. You know, Strategy's going down the route of obviously convertible bonds, but also now these perpetual equity, which are one's convertible, one's not convertible. He's trying to address different capital pools in the capital markets. And this makes a lot of sense. I mean, he's the biggest. He needs to get bigger. He needs to access bigger capital. Metaplanet, doing a fantastic job balancing the ATM in a very conservative way. So they're not smashing the ATM. And they're combining that with selling Bitcoin put options, which to me is genius, really. I mean, this is the power play of Metaplanet, right? They're selling downside put options, right? If they get there, they've been paid a premium for those options. If they get to the low price that they're selling the puts at, they have to buy Bitcoin at a low price, which they're doing anyway. They just issue more stock and they buy the Bitcoin. Right. If you or I tried to sell puts on Bitcoin, you know, let's say you sell a 75,000 strike put on Bitcoin for the end of June and we get there, you've been paid a premium, but now you have to come up with $75,000 and buy another Bitcoin, right? So that's problematic for your average person. But as a listed company who can print money through equity issuance, this is another way to financially engineer more Bitcoin yield. Right. And this is the key. You need to watch the actions of management, how they're innovating, how aggressive they're being. And to me, part of that is track record.
Well, let's talk about Metaplanet. It seems like they're doing things a little bit differently with their financial engineering of their Bitcoin acquisition plan.
Yeah.
It seems like they're looking to buy Bitcoin as low as they can versus where it seems like MicroStrategy is looking to buy the top forever in a way. And it looks like they're doing the ATM a little differently with warrants. Is that true where they're looking to kind of, can you maybe explain that a little bit? Yeah, and maybe sure. I misspoke.
So they're doing the put option strategy, but that's on the side.
Okay.
That's additional. They are taking the same approach to the ATM as Sailor. Keep buying the top, keep buying more Bitcoin. I mean, they're being very aggressive with it and they're doing it the right way. The structure that they're doing with the warrants is really just a way of getting around the regulatory structure of Japan.
Mm.
You can't do an ATM in Japan,
got it.
Whereas you can in the US. So they had to find a way to do it. And what they're doing is doing it via a multi-strike CB or warrant that essentially allows them to issue stock at the previous day's close or even a slight discount to that so that a hedge fund seller of the stock can sell the stock for them, right? And then buy it back from them the next day.
Right.
So that's the way that they managed to engineer a synthetic ATM.
Sure. And how would you explain sort of the Bitcoin yield and the accretive dilution? How do you explain those terms? And
well, Bitcoin yield is just... it's just a metric for saying how much more Bitcoin per share have I got year over year, right? So it's just a pure calculation. And obviously, that's the right way to look at these companies. You want to be looking at the Bitcoin yield. But as I said, there are a number of other things. Sorry, what was the question?
And accretive dilution.
Yeah. Okay. So accretive dilution is really, you know, in traditional finance, we think about dilution in a potentially negative way. And I, you know, I tell people often when Saylor first announced that 21 and 21 strategy, so 21 billion ATM, he had a 50 billion market cap. And I looked at that and I was like, okay, shit, an ATM that is 40% of his market cap live tomorrow, like, what is the stock going to do? Like, in traditional finance, that stock would have plummeted, probably 40%. But it didn't. It went up. And Bitcoin actually went down. So right. Intraday, his stock was up 2.5% with Bitcoin down after announcing a 40% dilution on his company. So this was the point where I suddenly started to go, okay, we're thinking about this wrong from the lens of traditional finance. So what is actually happening is it's what we call accretive dilution. So you take very simply the idea that he's got $100 of stock, right? And he's got $50 of Bitcoin. So his market cap's 100, his Bitcoin holding's 50. If he issues another 100 of market cap, so he goes to a 200 market cap, but uses all of that 100 to buy Bitcoin, he's only got 150 Bitcoin versus, exactly. Right. So he went from a 2x MNAV to what is that, 1.33x MNAV. Right.
Right.
And you see how accretive and aggressive that is. So then now you take a company like Mezzanine that's trading on a 5x MNAV, and I know they're aggressive. So I'm okay paying that MNAV because I know that he's going to go out there and dilute it very right. fast and accrete that value base up to the market cap I'm paying, which justifies
right.
the MNAV.
Right. So this kind of speaks to sort of MNAV and MNAV months to cover and sort of like, it seems like right now everyone's trying to, like, it seems like there's a lot of discovery
yes.
in Bitcoiners' yeah. usage of TradFi. So they're looking at MicroStrategy, or I keep calling it MicroStrategy, but Strategy has a lot of Bitcoin.
Yeah.
They can borrow a lot. They can issue a lot, but then smaller companies can kind of grow their stack faster. Maybe yeah. you could call it, kind of talk about that as Bitcoin torque, but they might have a higher MNAV.
Yep.
But they you know might have more money coming in the short term to chase it. Let's talk about something like with Metaplanet. They trade in like three different exchanges at three yep. different times under three different tickers. I mean, what do you make of this situation, or what would you? And none of this is financial advice, but like maybe someone bought some in the American market and they're looking at the price difference in the on the Tokyo exchange and there's on the German exchange. Like, how do you interpret that? And like, should people be trying to arbitrage that or just kind of buy in whatever market they have access to? And again, this is not to buy or not to buy. It's just like, if they are having questions around this, like, how do they think about it?
Yeah, look, something we've obviously seen with Metaplanet over the last 2 weeks is that you've had a differential between the dollar price and the yen price because the yen price was held down by the limit ups that you have in the Japanese market to control, to some degree, the Japanese retail investor that has historically gotten very overexcited about you know certain stocks. In fact, my company, Nomura, was the most valuable company in the world in the 1980s because everyone was just going insane in Japan for what it meant to be the number one broker in Japan. So what the Japanese regulator did was put in this limit up mechanisms, sort of like a cool-off period. And we saw that, you know, the U.S. stock traded up as high as $16. You know, implicitly, I think that was around 2,300 yen on the Japanese stock. And we were limit upping at like 800 and 1,000. So it just had about 4 or 5 days to try and catch up, which by which time people had calmed down a bit and realized it was getting a little bit over the top. But I think, you know, what happened with Metaplanet was, you know, what's interesting is Simon hasn't done a lot of public speaking. So people hadn't heard from him too much. And so we'd done an episode with him where I interviewed him and really drilled down into some of these sort of products and what he's thinking and how to measure these companies as well. And I think people got an insight into what a smart operator Simon is. And that really sort of opened up the stock to the more global market. So the dollar line obviously was free and open, as was the euro line that trades in Germany. while the Japanese stock was shot. So it was a little bit of an interesting trade. And there was a moment where I thought the shorts were going to be in a lot of trouble. I don't know if you know this as well, but Metaplanet is the most shorted stock in Japan. Like 27, 28% of their market cap is short. So it's huge. And in Japan, again, they have a bit of an interesting situation where to borrow a stock, the price that you have to pay in funding can be very volatile. So that's what happens in a limit up situation. Suddenly, if you're short, you're scrambling for longer term borrow. So it can push the margin price even higher, and you could end up paying like tens of percent a day to borrow a stock, which pushes the limit up situation even more aggressively. Because you're like, I'm just going to get out of the stock. I don't care how much money I'm ripping up. I just have to get out. So it can create a short squeeze situation, which, by the way, I don't think we're done with. We did see a lot of liquidity then happen a few days ago, and it stabilized, and we traded as low as 800 yen. But it's really set up for a short squeeze situation. That can happen. And as I said, it can be very painful if you're short a stock in Japan.
Right. It's very interesting how you brought up how the messaging is really important with these with these securities. I got to see firsthand Michael Saylor try to orange pill an unnamed CEO at his house. And he basically said, you know, you've raised money to buy Bitcoin. You've told the market that. And you need to buy the Bitcoin. You need to tell the market that you bought the Bitcoin. You need to tell the market that you're going to borrow more to buy more Bitcoin. You need to tell the market that you're going to buy the Bitcoin with that borrowed money in the future and borrow more after that. And how much you have to pound, because the market has expectations. And they price in sort of, I guess, like, are you going to buy $5 billion? And then they're not happy when you don't. And this is what they're expecting. I think a lot of people are sort of really appreciate the way Dylan LeClaire, you know, is probably running this ship. And some of the things they're doing, Dylan's very clear about the messaging. One other thing that seems very different is proof of reserves here. So as a traditional sort of TradFi background investor, how do you sort of like think about these different things with, you know, some companies have different MNAV, some have different strategies around like, you know, just even messaging around proof of reserves.
Okay, let's talk about proof of reserves. Sure. This is a bit of a pertinent point right now. Look, I think if you're Saylor, you're such a big player in the market that if someone can observe your wallet, then they can see exactly what you're doing when you're doing it. And so they can work out the way that you're starting to transact. And because his flow is so big, and actually, as I talked about before, with that illiquidity coming to the market, it's going to become even more pertinent to understand if you're a day trader trading Bitcoin or your market making desk or your OTC desk to understand what Saylor's doing. So he's obviously got some relationships with some OTC desks who treat his flow very carefully. But if everybody can suddenly see what he's doing, I can understand why there's a sensitivity there.
Yeah.
Now, you know, everybody. There's a lot of commentary about this on X. Like, well, if he's not posting proof of reserve, then he's obviously lying. He doesn't have a Bitcoin. That's bullshit. Like, they are an audited firm by KPMG. He's NASDAQ listed. If he's not buying the Bitcoin that he's saying he's buying, he runs the risk of going to jail, as does his entire executive team that are part of this. And KPMG auditors. So why would a billionaire that is already extremely successful, doesn't have to worry about, you know, future generations, he doesn't have kids, why would he do something and potentially risk the rest of his life to sit in prison just to fake it when he's getting given the money anyway? I mean, like, none of it makes sense. I understand that his don't trust verify is this mindset within Bitcoin, and I agree with that. But at the same time, you have to be practical and understand the reality of what we're dealing with. He has good reason to not necessarily be as transparent as Metaplanet, who is much smaller. I mean, it's not Metaplanet flows right here, right now, are not going to impact the market. Much as I love Simon and Dylan, they're not they're not going to impact the market. Sailor does impact the market, and that's important in traditional finance. It's important in all markets, but it's something that I recognize as a former trader. Like, if you get to see all the flow, you have a distinct advantage. And Sailor doesn't want to give that away. Like, obviously.
That's a great response and thought out. I appreciate that. Another thing I want to think about is maybe the traditional operating business. So MicroStrategy has the business intelligent unit. Metaplanet has a hotel, I think. I don't know much about it. As you know, someone with a TradFi background, how much do you look at the traditional operating business that they're running? And the reason I ask, I want to explore maybe leverage ratios, like how you feel about how much leverage maybe for any Bitcoin treasury company should they think about maybe getting up to or think or trying to achieve or get below, and the ability to maybe pay off future debt obligations with the operating company. How do you think through that?
Okay, so I think there's two things to talk about there. First of all, like, how do you think about a company that has an operating business along with a Bitcoin treasury? And I think a lot of people say, you know, oh, Marathon, they're only trading on one times MNAV, or I think they're a discount today. That's because the business is a challenged business.
Yeah.
Right. The reason that Simon's not trying to grow the hotel business is because it was a difficult business for him. And he admits that very openly. Like, that's the reason he got into being a Bitcoin treasury company, is because he's bored and said to him, like, what other options do we have at this point? I think Sailor is very public about it as well. Like, you know, he was a zombie company. He was just about washing his face every day, every year with the returns in the company. Wasn't growing. He couldn't find a way to grow the company. So that's one type of company. I think the evolution of all of this is we start to see very healthy balance sheet, cash generative companies start to come into that. And that's a different way of thinking about it. So I just did a panel with Mark Sees, my partner, and Borja from Roxham, and Mason from Easy Riders venture firm. And like, you were talking about Bitcoin as a hurdle rate. And obviously Mark is a private equity guy. He's buying companies with cash flow and trying to then make them more optimized and then sell them either privately or list them on the market through an IPO or whatever. And so, you know, the point there is the next iteration of all of this is cash flow generative companies taking Bitcoin, putting on the balance sheet. Of course, they don't want to be storing their cash in fiat. So Bitcoin forms the base. And actually, if you're savvy around financial engineering, so you can combine that Bitcoin treasury approach with a cash flow generative business, which again is another way of yielding more Bitcoin, right? So I think that's the next phase. And there's obviously the first phase of Bitcoin treasury companies has been people that have had to go there through a little bit through desperation, right? That's true of both MicroStrategy and of Metaplanet. But what happens next is the people that are not desperate, that have that cash flow generative business, start to pay attention to the value that this is giving these companies and saying, okay, well, what about if we were to do this? And what about if we were to financially engineer in a different way or replicate those other ways? I think so that is the next phase of all of this. And you imagine MicroStrategy, when Bitcoin's dropping, they struggle to buy more Bitcoin because the ATM isn't as elevated. Whereas a cash generative company could keep buying more Bitcoin. So you'd see a yield shift based on the market dynamic, which would be very interesting. And I forgot the other part of your question.
No, I think you addressed it. I mean, I would think that's the future end state, though, is that you got to be, you know, eventually it's Bitcoin flows, I would think. And I would think eventually we'll see even maybe companies that would produce a dividend do like SAT dividends, you know, some sort of BTC dividend. Where do you think TradFi is with sort of understanding this trade? I mean, Bitcoin is the best performing asset of all time of the last 15 years, you know, 12 out of the last 16 or something like that. MicroStrategy is one of the best performing stocks of the last few years. Metaplanet's one of the best performing stocks of the last year. It still seems like Metaplanet's not on Robinhood yet. So full force of retail is not even, doesn't even have like flows in. But when does like institutional investors and TradFi really like, and maybe they are here and maybe I'm just not seeing it yet, or seeing is not the right word. Maybe they're here, maybe they're coming. Like, where do you think that's going when it's just more normal to invest in these things and more mainstream?
Look, I'd say two things there. First of all, I have a big network still in the traditional finance space, and I would say 70, 80% of that network have no clue what Bitcoin is. And MicroStrategy is a Ponzi for them very clearly, and they don't understand any of it. And the other thing I would say is that the 20% are being woken up to some degree by what Metaplanet, predominantly MicroStrategy, are doing. Because MicroStrategy are forcing it, because they're trying to allocate to the, or sorry, they're trying to find those different capital pools that can allocate to them. They're waking up and shaking the convertible bond investor who's like looking at this asset going, this volatility is insane and I love volatility. So I need to understand why this volatility is happening. So slowly he's converting, for want of a better word, convertible bond investors into people that understand Bitcoin. He's now hitting the fixed income markets, which is a much bigger allocation pool. So the work that Saylor and other Bitcoin treasury companies are doing is actually really important for the adoption by institutional finance. And I, you know, a lot of people get upset about this. And I had a chat on Twitter about it yesterday with someone who was obviously a very hardcore Bitcoiner. Like, I hate the fact that Wall Street's involved in it. You don't understand. If you want to take over the system, you have to slowly get into the system and start to permeate it in every single aspect. And I think this is the Trojan horse is the Bitcoin treasury companies. And, you know, obviously Saylor's leading that from the front.
What do you think about maybe price discovery? Something like, where do you think there is more true or better or accurate price discovery? I think of the Bitcoin network because of it's a transparent ledger, but most people can self-custody and you would think that you can interpret that as an illiquid supply until they move it back to an exchange, which could happen at any price point. So you kind of have less sort of data points on the Bitcoin network in a lot of ways versus maybe securities where, you know, in the ETFs, it's very clear how many shares they've issued, how much Bitcoin per share, you know, MicroStrategy. You can look at the 10K, and look at what their kind of guidelines are and when they're going to issue based on their program and how they structure things. So where do you think about like better or truer price discovery?
Look, I think you do actually see a lot of metrics on the Bitcoin network. I mean, I work closely with Willy Wu, who's obviously a pioneer of Bitcoin, blockchain network analysis.
Yeah.
You know, he's always going on about paper Bitcoin and getting very frustrated that the data points aren't as clear anymore. So I hear the point you're making. I think what's very interesting is watching the ETF flows and being able to see ETF flows into Bitcoin versus out of gold. Like, it's quite logical for an investor now. And I think this is a pitch of everyone that's running around out there, the BlackRock ETF guys, the Bitwise guys, Fidelity guys. Obviously, the sales pitch is you've got 10% in gold. Take that 10%, cut it in half, put 5% into digital gold. So we're really seeing that with the flows that are coming through the ETF. So, you know, look, as I said, Willie's frustration is you don't see so much data on chain anymore. That's only going to increase. You know, you've obviously got Lightning transactions that don't obviously show you so much data. But, you know, there's enough there that you can kind of see what's happening.
Right.
Like, I'm getting myself a little bit frustrated with the exchange balance metric that you see on Glassnode. Like, it's dropping. You see a very clear trend, but the number somehow doesn't seem to be changing that much. But we are obviously walking into very illiquid supply. So when you talk about price discovery, I think we're looking at the final 6 months of this year to be a lot of price discovery for Bitcoin, right, as I alluded to earlier.
I mean, one way you could look at sort of Bitcoin price, it's very expensive, you could say. And then you could look at the unit price bias is what I'm getting at there. you know, not total market cap, not total addressable market. One way to me, it seems very inexpensive, and I think it's the most inexpensive thing on earth. But one way to frame that is I think of a high net worth individual who's looking to convert a portion of their wealth. So maybe they have 10% in gold. And at some point, they're going to call up their broker who manages some of their affairs and say, I want half of my gold in Bitcoin, and I don't care what the price is. And the way I also think about that is like, if Bitcoin's $1 million a coin, that could seem very expensive, but that's only one penny a Satoshi. And if you frame it that way to your client, like it's a 1 cent, your client would be like, I don't care if I pay 2 cents a Satoshi at this point. Like, I want to convert from one to the other, and I want to do it today and not tomorrow. So how do you think about it from maybe like the perspective of a high net worth individual or an institutional investor who's moving huge? I mean, could you see sort of like that outlook on it, or is it going to be more like, no, I really want in at 137 versus, you know, 219?
Yeah, you're always going to get people mucking around on price. I mean, we used to have a saying in traditional finance, don't be a dick for a tick. And, you know, you see it a lot. I mean, people who've got it and then they try and muck around for the price. And frankly, if you're going to pay 107,000 versus 97,000, arguably, what difference does it make? But, you know, people get obsessed with this stuff and, you know, you're never going to get rid of that. I think the unit bias thing is very important. Obviously, there's this debate going on with sats versus bitcoins right now. I'm very much in the sat camp. Like, people understand dollars and cents. Like, it's not rocket science. I think actually, if you were then to convert everything to just being bitcoins, it's a bit of a ridiculous idea, and everyone's gonna go, so wait, hang on, I've got 9,000 Bitcoin, like, that's insane. So I think it'd just be confusing for people, and so I'm very much in the sats camp because that's where we've been, and I don't understand even why we're talking about it again. But unit bias is a problem. I think that people need to really convert their mindset to, how much Bitcoin do I have and how is that Bitcoin stack growing? And not really be focused at all on dollars. I mean, dollars is the failing system. So you want to be focused on Bitcoin, right? And I think, you know, I had a sit down with the head of asset management at an unnamed private bank, banking group recently. And, you know, I've been talking about Bitcoin for years. And so I finally got into the point of saying, okay, you got 3 kids, buy 1 Bitcoin for each kid. He can definitely afford it. So he texts me later, he's like, okay, you've really got me thinking about this. How much is 1 Bitcoin? At the time, it was $70,000. It's like, $70,000? I'm not going to pay $70,000. That's insane. But, you know, I mean, you learn the lesson the hard way. Everyone gets Bitcoin at the price they deserve, as Saylor says.
So. Yeah, I hear you. This has been so dope. We only have a minute or two more left. If you could, like, what are you most excited about in the space right now? It seems like a really exciting time. And then, you know, any parting words you want to leave, you know, the listeners with and let them know where they find you and your work?
Look, I'm obviously very focused on the Bitcoin treasury play. I really believe that this is only the beginning of this innovation cycle. We're going to see more and more different types of companies move into the Bitcoin treasury space. But what I'm excited about is more and more financialized companies coming in and saying and creating even more tools than we're already seeing to grow their Bitcoin yield. The other thing, of course, is nation state FOMO. There's no question that the US adopting a Bitcoin strategic reserve is going to have ripple effects into nation states elsewhere in the world. I mean, every single one of the major competitors to the US dollar, BRIC nations, now need to very seriously think about what they're doing for their Bitcoin strategy. If they're not, they're really failing their people. So yeah, I think nation state adoption is going to be a big thing. And that's why I think that the upside volatility is arguably going to be a lot higher this time than downside volatility.
Yeah, I could see that. I think volatility is only going to increase. I'd love to listen in on a conversation between you and Samson Mao sometime. Dude, this has been so awesome. Thank you so much for coming on the show. Yes, really appreciate it.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Bitcoin Matrix. If you enjoyed the conversation, don't forget to like, subscribe, and drop a comment below with any questions or thoughts you may have. We'd love to hear from you. You can support the show by checking out our sponsors and affiliate links in the description. It helps keep bringing you great content while connecting you with awesome products that I believe in. Share this episode with your friends, family, or anyone curious about Bitcoin. And let's keep growing this community together. Stay curious, keep stacking, and I'll catch you in the next one.